Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler.
How are you doing today?
I am glowing.
All right.
With happiness. Because I just finished up my week volunteering with Operation Surf, with the veterans who came to town for a week of learning to surf in Avila and Morro Bay. And I don't want to diminish the experience by trying to put adjectives to how it was. So I will just say that there are many ordinary people doing extraordinary things in the world. And Van Carassa and his group and the volunteer surf instructors and the volunteers who stood on the beach and stood in the deep water to help recover wayward surfboards and the people who put together meals night after night. My heart is so full, I can hardly fit it into my bra. It's just been an incredible experience, you know, that reaffirmation that 95% of all humans are good people and trying to do their best in the world. And, you know, last week we talked about, I talked about getting out into the community and going to see a show and, you know, being in community with the people in the theater, not necessarily speaking to them, but having a common experience, and how these things really help to support our mental health and well-being, and that it's easy to get discouraged and kind of turn inward and isolate and get pretty dark and watch way too much television. And then that becomes, you know, kind of our spot. We become hermits and we start dwelling in those negative feelings. And then that depressive position comes over us. And then we feel like, I must be sick. But if you look out, you realize that this movement towards feeling depressed or feeling anxious started when you stopped engaging in what's going on around you in small and meaningful ways or in big and meaningful ways. And I can hardly wait for the next opportunity to be of service with Operation Surf. It was just amazing. So I am aglow.
Wonderful. And Van was a guest on your show a couple weeks back,
yes,
correct?
Yes, he was, if anyone wanted to hear it. And he was a guest a couple years ago. I've had Van on a few times. And I want to remind people that if you don't know about Operation Surf and you're curious about the work they do, there's a documentary that was done called Resurface, and it's on Netflix. And it's only 30 minutes, so it's a quick watch, but it'll give you a great idea of what's going on. And then if you see Van Carassa around town, you'll want to run up and throw your arms around him and give him a big kiss, because what he does with these men just out of love in his heart is remarkable. And I wanted to bring up Van, I wanted to bring up Operation Surf again to tie into our conversation today, because what drove Van into doing this work was his recovery from years of addiction and trying to kind of make amends with himself or deal with shame or overcome, you know, what he felt was a challenging childhood, and to do something more meaningful with his adult life. And he found that the key to his own recovery was in being able to give back and work with these veterans and help them find the joy of surf, just as he had found his salvation in getting in the water and riding these waves day after day. And that has given this gift to 10 years of giving this gift to veterans and to also all the volunteers to get out into the water and to feel the sun in your, you know, face and the salt water in your hair and in your eyes, and just to feel that healthy glow of being alive can really help support recovery. And so this week I have a guest with me in the studio, Dr. Michael McGee, and he is the clinical director for The Haven.
Chief Medical Officer.
Thank you. Yes. Which is a recovery, what do you call it, a center?
Yeah, I would call it a psychiatric facility that specializes in the treatment of addictions.
I'm glad that he is here to keep me honest. But it's located here in San Luis Obispo. And Dr. McGee and I had been in contact because he's written a book called The Joy of Recovery. And it's a new 12-step guide to healing from addiction. And if you look at the cover, you can already see that it's not your average recovery or addiction book. There's a lot of positive energy around it. And so I invited Dr. McGee to come on and be my guest for a couple of reasons. One, because I I am drawn to anything that helps people find recovery and peace and healing in a way that is based in our own ability to heal, getting back into nature, finding those things that we're passionate for, not being too connected to or dependent on the pharmaceutical model. So I was excited to talk about that. Also, because over the 10 years I've done this show, I've invited a few psychiatrists on the show, and for some reason, they don't want to be my guest. I don't know why. But Dr. McGee agreed to come on and talk with me about the work he does and how he came to do this work. And so I'm looking forward to our conversation about the potential for recovery for anyone suffering from addiction of any kind. And also for the people who love someone who's struggling with an addiction and how they can find peace and healing as well. So we will be opening up the phone lines during our conversation today. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation by finding us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We also are trying to be more active on Instagram, so you can follow us at elizabeth_TRT and get updates or leave messages there. And as always, you can listen to our previous shows by visiting kcbx.org or subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts or NPR One or however you find them. Hit subscribe and the shows will be uploaded each week. Tyler gets them up very quickly, so you can listen to them almost the same day. And if you leave a review, that helps get the word out to more people to find the show. So as always, I appreciate you being here for the conversation. I look forward to speaking to Dr. McGee, and we'll be back to get started. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Me, brother, when you need a hand, we all need somebody to lean on. I just might have a problem that you'll understand. We all need somebody to lean on. Lean on me when you're a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And welcome Dr. Michael McGee to the show.
Thank you.
All right. So before we jump too quickly into the Haven and the work that's being done around addiction, I'd like to get to know a little bit more just about you, because my experience in the mental health profession is that no one kind of goes into this work because they grew up in an idyllic childhood home, that usually something draws us to doing mental health work. And you're a psychiatrist, so can you talk a little bit about how you found this profession?
Sure. I grew up with good parents, but in a home where there was suffering and struggling, I and my siblings grew up largely sort of alone. My parents were very hardworking, and we were sort of left to our own devices, and had a babysitter at one point who was abusive, really a very unhappy childhood. And I think that probably is the core of what sort of drove me to get into this field. And I remember one day I came home from school in first grade and with my first report card. And I had an A in math. And it was my first time. I didn't really know what grades were, really. It didn't have any significance to me. And I remember bringing that home, as I was told to do, to my mom. And she looked at it, and her eyes lit up. And I remember her taking out a purse and giving me 50 cents and saying, I'll give you 50 cents for every A that you get. And, boy, that was just like something clicked. I thought, oh, well, I've been recognized, and I can get love and money if I get A's. And I think that really started me on a track of trying to find a way in this unhappy existence of having a sense of some meaning and value and worth, and really developed at that point sort of an addiction, if you will, my own addiction to achievement. And to being special through achievement, as a way of dealing with a feeling of being unworthy mm-hmm. and whole. So that's sort of how I got into this field. Also, I have addiction in my family, so family members of my who suffer from addiction.
And so the addiction to achievement, though, in some ways worked to your benefit because it got you to medical school. Because it takes, I would imagine, a lot of dedication to get to medical school, and you went to Stanford?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So that's not your everyday school. So was that your plan? You know, who said, hey, Michael, you should be a doctor someday, or was that always something you were driven to do? And did you always know you wanted to be a psychiatrist, or did you find that through your medical training? What was the path?
Well, I always had a love for learning and a love for science and biology. And I grew up in a non-religious home, and I can still remember when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, just being, I was a biology major, and I felt like I was studying God. Hmm. It was just incredible. And so I had wanted to be a doctor from a very young age. It just was just a sort of a driving passion for me. And once I got into medical school, I got into an MD-PhD program, a six-year fully paid program, and I did 2 years of biomedical research. And at the end of that, I just realized that working in a laboratory was not for me. And at that time, I was reading Eric Byrne and Eric Fromm and really fell in love with psychology and psychiatry. And a lot of medicine is really just looking at laboratories and X-ray results and very little interaction with people. But the field of psychiatry is different, at least back then mm-hmm. it was. People actually sat and talked about the depths of their lives. And so I was really drawn to that. So that I think that combined with my own woundedness, I think, just made for a space where I felt deep compassion for the people that I was caring for. And so I think that's sort of why that brought me to that field.
And the wounded healer.
Yes, exactly.
Giving back.
Yes.
And so you said, you know, back in the day when you became a psychiatrist,
yes.
And your medical training was at Harvard, true?
Medical school at Stanford, okay. And residency training at Harvard.
At Harvard. Because
yeah.
I just want people to understand this is like serious training at some of the top institutions. And mm-hmm. can you talk a bit about how you see the field of psychiatry has changed in the years? And how long have you been practicing?
I've been practicing for 30 years.
So in the 30 years since then, what kind of changes have you seen in the helping professions and
sure.
the medical end of it?
Well, it's the psychiatry has become relegated pretty much to almost doing just psychopharmacology. Managed care, in its economic wisdom, sees that they can pay much less to a social worker, for example, for psychotherapy. And so that is sort of economically edged most psychiatrists out of doing psychotherapy.
And is that something you miss?
Oh, terribly. I'm really blessed that I do have an active psychotherapy practice. And I find that to be the most rewarding part of my job.
And so over 30 years, was addiction your primary focus in your practice, or how did you... You know, what were the steps that took you to finding this niche in recovery?
My very first job outside of my residency was working for what at that time was called a terrible term, but it was called a dual diagnosis program. It was an inpatient unit, and I was associate medical director there. And so right from the beginning out of my training, I really had an active interest in addictions, I think in part because of preconsciously or unconsciously, because of the addiction in my own family, there was a part of me that felt somehow magically that if I specialized in that I could somehow be of help to my own family.
Mm-hmm. Hope that we can fix what feels impossible. And so did you work in centers, you know, with an addiction prior to coming to the Central Coast, or did you?
Yes, I've been working with addictions patients in one form or another for the past 30 years.
And so what do you find to be one the biggest challenge in doing that work? Mm-hmm. And how has the field of addiction treatment or recovery treatment changed or not changed?
You know, the field is rapidly changing right now, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write my book, because this is a time of incredible, incredible hope for people who suffer from this condition. I think it's really changed. Really, we didn't know what to do with addictions 30, 40, 50 years ago. And we grew up with a system where there was psychiatric illness and then there was addictions. And really, we separated off addictions really out of our own incompetence, even though they are mental illnesses. But if you imagine, it would almost be like if back then we didn't know how to treat depression, we would have had mental illness and depression.
Right.
But we're getting to the point where there are a number of evidence-based treatments that are available. And I think that we're seeing a healing of that separation of mental health and addiction to just mental health, including addictions.
So for people to know the term of dual diagnosis, the idea was that on one end you had a mental illness and then you would also be suffering from addiction, and it would be two separate treatments you would need to receive.
That's right. If you think about it, it'd be like imagining that you were suffering from depression and anxiety. And, you have depression and anxiety, so therefore you have a dual diagnosis.
Right. You'd go to two different clinicians for two different treatments.
Right. Exactly.
So now we're seeing it more inclusively.
I think we're moving in that direction.
So I guess the part that concerns me is that when we look at mental health or mental illness, that part of the way we've moved forward is it lumped a lot of mental illness onto the same spectrum. So then you have psychotic breaks and schizoaffective disorder and, you know, chronic depression, major depressive disorder on the same spectrum as people with situational anxiety, and that they're being treated or seen in the same ways. And on that same spectrum is addiction that also comes in many forms. How do we deal with that? Are you seeing that being addressed from the psychiatric perspective?
You know, that is just such an excellent question. Amazingly excellent question. The way I see it is that addictions, We as a society have a hard time really understanding what addiction is and really talking about it. And I see addictions as sort of a spectrum disorder where there's a spectrum of impairment. On one, just like you said, on one extreme, there can be very severe neurobiological illnesses where absolutely 9 times out of 10, you do need a medication to help you survive from really a devastating neurobiological illness. But then you can go to the other extreme where you have some degree of engaging in a compulsive, self-destructive behavior where there's some degree of loss of control. But again, that could be just maybe as subtle as my own addiction, which was to compulsively striving for achievement and to somehow to be special rather than to be useful to other people. So we see sort of this spectrum of impairment that sort of falls within that category of addiction.
So, you know, and we also hear the term disease connected with addiction. And if I'm hearing you correctly, then the disease model would be seen in the far end of the spectrum where you see schizoaffective or neurobiological changes to the brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. But then on the far end, we would have situational anxiety or normalized depression or compulsions to be perfect that wouldn't be considered a disease if we were looking at it from that perspective. But from a managed care perspective, and for a lot of clinicians, they don't seem to separate that out. And so you have a lot of people who consider themselves diseased and therefore don't know how to move forward. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think all human beings lie somewhere on a spectrum of impairment and suffering to some degree or another. My own approach towards addiction is very much informed by a mindfulness type of approach, and really it's part of the normal human condition, just our basic neurobiology, for example, to push away pain and to grasp for pleasure in compulsive ways, which then lead to tremendous suffering. And those really serve as the root of a lot of compulsive, addictive-type behaviors. But they're not necessarily neurobiological permanent damage to the brain's drive-reward system. They're more on the other spectrum.
So it would seem that in order to have more success with recovery, we'd have to first help people to distinguish between a disease-modeled disorder and a situational or a lifestyle disorder.
Right. It's almost like a difference between the software and the hardware.
Okay, explain.
Or the way that the software and the hardware work together. Okay. There really is also this spectrum of mental illness to mental wellness or wholeness and vitality. And all of us live somewhere along that spectrum. We all suffer. We all behave more or less skillfully or unskillfully in different situations, but not everybody is labeled as having a mental illness just because of suffering or having anxiety or depression or behaving unskillfully. So, really, the world is gray and reality lies along a spectrum rather than black and white. Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is Dr. Michael McGee. He's a psychiatrist, and he's written a book, The Joy of Recovery, that we're going to get into in a moment. But I wanted to set kind of the stage of how you got to the point of writing this book, mm-hmm. and also your understanding or your lens through which you look at mm-hmm. addiction. And so you've been doing this for 30 years, and so I imagine you've seen a lot of trial balloons of working with addiction that failed mm-hmm. to come to where you are today. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure which direction you want to go, but do you want to start with how, you know, you found sure. success, or do you want to start with, here's all the things that I found over 30 years that yeah. weren't working yeah. and weren't helpful? Because, you know, the recovery rate for addictions is incredibly low, right? 85% of people yeah. end up back in their addiction. So that's got to be a hard
right.
field to be into. So yeah. take it where you'd like.
Sure. So, you know, that's another, I think addiction is maybe one of the most misunderstood conditions. And part of what I hope through our discussion today is to sort of shed some light on the nature of this. Addiction is a little bit, not completely, but a little bit like conditions like diabetes or congestive heart failure or asthma, where these are long-term chronic relapsing and remitting illnesses, and where there can be periods of remission and then periods of recurrence of symptoms of addiction, and that those recurrence of symptoms can be either full-blown or partial or minor. So there is this idea that somehow people go into remission permanently. That is the case for some people, but for a lot of people, rather than thinking about that as success, it's better to think about how much time are you spending in remission, and when you do have recurrences of addiction, how severe is it? To what degree does it impair your life? So then you're thinking, rather than black and white terms, more in terms of degrees and percentages. And in that sense, people need to understand that addiction is really very, very hopeful condition or disease or however you want to call it, that really there are effective treatments, and there's just tremendous hope and capacity if you suffer from an addiction, for you to recover and really realize joy despite having perhaps a neurobiological disturbance in your brain's drive reward system. So it really, I think the one thing that's unique about having the condition of addiction, it's not completely unique, but what's really important about it is that your recovery from this, if we will call it an illness, your recovery from this illness really depends on your own attitude, and it really depends on your willingness to do the work of recovery. And that's very similar to other chronic disease conditions like diabetes or congestive heart failure, where you really do have to make lifestyle changes and you really do have to invest a certain amount of work to be able to secure your own recovery.
And when we look at addiction, there's so many things You talked about the compulsion, and you use compulsion too. So are compulsion and addictions, from your definition, interchangeable? Are they different spectrums of addiction? Yeah.
So the general societal definition of addiction, which differs a little bit from the official medical definitions of addiction, but generally you have a repetitive habitual behavior in which there is a degree of compulsion to engage in that behavior, and there is a degree of impairment in your control over that behavior, which then results in adverse consequences, harm to yourself or others. So that's sort of a general definition. Mm-hmm. And if you use that as a general definition, then a lot of things, which we don't typically call addictions, actually fall into that kind of a definition. So we have some confusion as a society about what's an addiction and what's not. And again, I think if you think of it as more of a spectrum condition, then it's easier to see what kind of conditions have sort of addiction-like qualities. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you could be addicted to gossiping, mm-hmm. or to comparing yourself to other people.
Or your screen.
Or your screen, or to spending money, or to having...
Falling in love.
Right. to relationships.
Yeah.
And they can have addictive-like qualities. And I think it's useful to think about it that way, rather than saying, well, this is an addictive disorder.
Yeah, because I think one of the things that I always grapple with is this idea that you catch it like a disease, like the flu, and you don't catch addictions. There are things that kind of creep up on us, and we mm-hmm. have a temperament towards addiction. Mm-hmm. They talk about the biological tendency towards addiction, and mm-hmm. you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that with anxiety, people say, well, anxiety and depression are in your genes or genetically, you know, you're just predisposed, mm-hmm. but it's only 30%, if not less, that you're mm-hmm. predisposed mm-hmm. biologically. Mm-hmm. So 70% of this mm-hmm. arises from the situations you live in or the behaviors that you engage mm-hmm. in. And mm-hmm. that when we think about things, if we say it's biologically driven, then I think people feel like they have less control mm-hmm. and it's mm-hmm. easier to give up.
Yes. It turns out that addictions, there's really a very large epidemiological literature on the genetic versus the environmental contribution to addiction. And generally, a way to think about that is that the genetic contribution to addiction varies from about 40% for hallucinogen disorders up to about 60 or maybe 70% for amphetamine and cocaine. With other addictions being somewhere in that range of 40 to 70% genetic contribution.
Right, so that if your parents had an addiction to an opioid, mm-hmm. you have a 60% chance of also following in their footsteps? Or explain to me what that means.
It's complicated. what it means is that you're probably more likely to be vulnerable to developing a neurobiological dysregulation of your brain's drive reward system okay. if you're exposed to opioids, if your parents had an opioid use disorder.
But could their opioid use disorder have triggered their chemistry to change that then impacted their children? Or is this something we're seeing from five generations out just waiting in the wings to happen?
Yeah. As far as we know, that's a really good question. It's probably a genetic vulnerability. There may be what are called epigenetic factors as well, but it's still poorly understood at this point. But I think the biggest point is that there is a huge environmental component as well. And really, the way you live your life, your way of being in the world, your the environment that you're in, the degree of skill to which you live your life with your ability to bear distress and to resolve distress in intelligent, loving ways rather than numbing your pain with pleasure-inducing substances. Those all factor in as well as the genetic component as well. There was an interesting study of Vietnam veterans who were addicted to heroin. And when they came back from Vietnam, most of them stopped using heroin, showing that really there's a very large environmental component that contributes to the development of addiction.
This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Dr. Michael McGee, and we're here today talking about addiction and hope moving forward for those who are struggling or suffering and for those who love someone who's suffering. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We're going to come back, open up the phone lines, and talk about the joy of recovery and how you can move forward and experience a life of full pleasure in a healthy way. Unseen by the others in the hurt, can you promise to something? Promise to something into the arms of magic. We can stop running, we can stop running. I have a vision of myself breaking the finish line. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and Dr. Michael McGee and I are, we have so much to cover. We just looked down and realized, wow, we have a lot of talking points, and I think we just covered one. And the one that I wanted to ask is, when we were talking about the understanding this idea, the disease model behind addiction, and all of the kind of the myths that are out there about, you know, addicts and addiction, and that they're somehow kind of dark creatures in the corner who are weak somehow and couldn't get along in life, and that everyone else is somehow mastering every day. But there's a spectrum of addictions that we have. As you said, there's healthy and unhealthy addictions. I remember reading Stanton Peale's work about addiction, and he said there are seven addictions that are really difficult, the most difficult to come off of. And love is the hardest of them all. And it includes fatty foods, heroin, cigarettes, cocaine. I can't remember what the other one was, but he said love was the hardest addiction of all, because it releases, when you are falling in love and love someone, it releases all these pleasure hormones in our body. We become flooded with them. And so then when that love and those feelings are removed, we withdraw, like we're coming down off of cocaine or heroin or really good fatty foods. And so I think that model helps us understand or normalize the idea that all of us as humans have the potential and probably are participating in some sort of addictive behavior every day of our life.
I think that's true. I think if we look at the way we live our lives, are we engaging in compulsive behaviors where we have some degree of a feeling of not having difficulty controlling those behaviors in ways that cause harms to ourselves or others? And I think we can all, if we're very honest, can look at our lives and see that we all struggle with that to some degree. I would say about in love, I see falling in love as very different from love, very, very different. And actually, I really, one of the reasons why I wrote the book, my book, is that I really see recovery as the practice of love. I think that love starts with an attitude. It starts with a reverent, deeply respectful attitude towards this precious gift of existence and towards life. And that's followed by a very serious endeavor in the practice of nurturing and enhancing life, which is work. So I really see love as a combination of attitude followed by action, which is very different from the experience of falling in love, which is sort of a form of nature's brilliant way of rendering us into a temporary psychotic state.
Absolutely.
So that we can get attached to another person and then hopefully then have the opportunity to really do the hard work of realizing the full fruits of true love.
Well, and I can't remember where I read this idea of the spiritual aspect of addiction, and that part of addiction is that inherent seeking to fulfill that emptiness that we experience when we don't have love or a sense of awe or connection to that spiritual being, which I think is what is attached to that 12-step idea of surrendering to a higher power.
Yes.
That when we can find inherently that sense of love and awe, we don't need to seek it through pleasure.
Yes, that's exactly right. I see addiction as, in the more severe forms, as being a medical illness that does have a spiritual solution. And one of the things that I write about is, and the reason why 12 steps only works for about 15% of people who suffer from addiction, is that I think that the definition of spirituality in a traditional 12-step approach, while it's wonderful for those for whom it works, and I really think that the 12 steps is one of the greatest inventions in all human history for growth and character transformation. So I honor the 12 steps. But we need something broader and more inclusive for everybody else. And so as I think about spirituality, I think about it as being in a reverent and harmonious relationship with reality. And that relationship can have two different components. One would be the immanent, in other words, your and I relationship with each other, our relationship with the listeners right now, our relationship with our friends and families, our relationship with the world, making sure that we're driving on the right side of the road. That's a good way of staying in harmony with reality. But then there's the transcendent dimension, which not everybody experiences, and that's a sense of being in harmonious and loving relationship with something that we intuit that is beyond reality, that some people call God or a higher power. I like thinking, instead of a higher power, of thinking of a greater power. We are all part of one incredibly amazing interconnected web of life that sustains us and that we are a part of. And when we're spiritually healthy, we wake up to see the miracle of this moment of existence. That we are all a piece of the universe, if you will. We are all the universe aware of itself. And how amazing is that? And if you feel the wonder and awe and joy of that, how could you ever want to give that up by doing something self-destructive?
And then I think of someone who was written a prescription for opiates coming out of a surgery, and then that becomes a full-blown addiction. And how is that a result of a spiritual emptiness?
Yeah. So that's where the nature, nurture, gene, environment thing comes into play. About 6 to 12% of people who are given a prescription for opioids for longer than several days will undergo a neurobiological alteration of their brain's drive reward system, and they will develop an addiction. And that's regardless of their spiritual status. It just will happen. Now, what they do with that compulsion is hugely impacted by their spiritual status. If you are somebody who can experience distress and allow yourself to tolerate that distress and be connected to other people for support and guidance and have a sense of reverence for your experience, regardless of whether it's pleasurable or painful, then you will be spiritually more empowered to be able to deal with those compulsions and urges and cravings to use opioids than somebody who doesn't have that healthy spirituality.
So it's the connection, the community. You know, I've always heard, because of Al-Anon, and you know, the idea that your loved one can't love you to health, your loved one cannot fix you. But I'm hearing a little bit that you're saying that love and that connection, that community, can actually offer the support.
Yes.
Of healing. So what's the difference between trying to love someone and to get them to, you know, to fix them,
right,
and loving them in support?
I'm great. Thanks for asking that question. It's such an important question. About one out of every three people in America, if you include food addiction, suffers from some sort of addiction. And what that means is that we all suffer from addiction. Every single one of us suffers from addiction. And every one of us has a loved one who in some way suffers from addiction. And how do we help those people? Well, it turns out there's good research that shows that we have about a 70% impact rate on helping people to recover from addiction. But it's not by nagging, it's not by pleading, it's not by lecturing, it's not by threatening, it's not by abandoning. Those ways don't work. But there are skillful ways to help people to help nurture and encourage them into the process of recovery. And basically, there's four principles. And the first principle comes right from behavioral conditioning, which is if you catch somebody engaging in sobriety and recovery behavior, heavily reward them.
It's like finding your child doing something well and saying, I love when you pick up after
exactly.
yourself.
Yeah, if they come home sober, plan for a great dinner and a great evening together so that they experience, wow, life is really good if I'm not addicting. And the second thing is to remove those rewards and to disengage when somebody's engaging in negative addiction-like behavior. So that way, rather than punishing them, you're basically not rewarding them for those behaviors and maybe disengaging. So if somebody comes home drunk, for example, honey, I'm not going to be spending time with you tonight because you've been drinking. There's food in the fridge. Feel free to make yourself whatever you would like. I'm going to go into the other room and read a book. Something like that. Again, neutral in sort of a compassionate way, not with anger, but just as a way of very mindfully and intentionally disengaging when people are engaging in negative behaviors. The third principle of influencing people, because we all have enormous influence over each other. The third principle is to engage in unconditional positive communication. So refrain from name-calling or threatening or putting down or any kind of abusive language, to use I statements. You know, honey, when you got drunk at the party, I felt really mortified, and I need to let you know that I really can't allow myself to be in that position anymore.
As opposed to, you're a jerk, you ruined our night, you're the worst person I ever met.
Exactly.
To go with, it's the same thoughts, but with a more positive moving forward. I hurt when you drink.
Exactly.
Okay.
If I attack you, mm-hmm. you're going to feel defensive.
Right, and I'll attack back.
And if I don't attack you and just sort of state my experience with love, then you're going to be more open to hearing what I have to say. And then the fourth principle is to not shield people from the natural negative consequences of their unskillful behavior.
Okay.
So if somebody gets drunk and they call you and say, please come and pick me up, you say, sorry, I'm not going to do that. You'll have to walk home. Again, this is a tricky one because
you don't want them driving.
Right, exactly. Or let's say that somebody, you know, sleeps in and they miss work. Maybe your impulse is to call the boss and say, and call in sick for them. That's enabling behavior, and better to let them face the music of the consequences of their behavior. Sometimes that's tricky because sometimes if their adverse consequences could be your adverse consequences as well.
The family income is now lost.
Exactly. So it's a tricky one. It takes courage. But ultimately, if you can minimize enabling and have people experience the pain. See, I think we live in a society which is pain intolerant. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to understand in healing from addiction that pain is a great teacher. In fact, pain is probably one of the best things that we can have. If you look back at your own life, you probably notice that the times that were the most painful were the times of the most learning and growth. Mm-hmm. And so in helping somebody recover from addiction, we have to honor pain as a great teacher.
My guest is Dr. Michael McGee, and we're talking about addiction from the perspective of a new book that Dr. McGee has written, The Joy of Recovery, and also his work through The Haven, which is a psychiatric recovery center here in San Luis Obispo. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, our number is 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And so, Dr. McGee, our hour's going so fast, I don't want it to go so fast that we don't talk about, first, The Haven and what mm-hmm. brought you to San Luis Obispo and what kind of mm-hmm. work is going on mm-hmm. there.
So The Haven, I'm very proud of The Haven. It started about 2 years ago. We are joint commission accredited. We are a young and growing program. What I'm most proud about our program is that we are an evidence-based program, which is rooted within the traditions of evidence-based treatments for mental illness, including for the mental illness of addiction.
Is the Haven only for treating people with addictions?
Yes, we specialize in the treatment of addictions, but as you probably know, 70 to 80%, if not more, of people who suffer from addictions also suffer from trauma and other psychiatric illnesses like depression and anxiety and bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and personality disorders and post-traumatic stress disorder. And you can't treat one without attending to the other. The best treatments are treatments which are integrated and comprehensive, either that we provide ourselves or that we provide in coordination and collaboration with other mental health treatment providers.
And is it an in-house treatment, or people?
So we have residential treatment. It's a social detox type of model. We have a detoxification house. We also have a men's residential and a women's acute residential. And then we have a sober living home for men, and then another one for women. So we have five homes in total. And then we have a partial hospital program, which is about 6 hours a day of treatment, 5 days a week. And then we have an intensive outpatient program, which is about 3 hours a day, several days a week. And we're just now starting our Haven Wellness Group, which is outpatient treatment, which is where the most important work happens. Although the intensive work is important, the acute intensive work, true and lasting healing and transformation take place in the outpatient setting over a period of 3 to 5 years for most people. And so I'm very excited that we're starting now to open up to give outpatient treatment as well.
Because it is that maintenance piece that people struggle with most, is having that long-term love and support.
Yeah.
And not, you know, you've been to rehab, so you should be fine. But this idea,
right,
that it goes on.
Yeah.
And does insurance cover this?
Yes. Insurance covers, okay, our treatment.
And is it only for drug and alcohol addiction? What about sleeping pills? Or
yes, we really see ourselves as specializing in the treatment of all addictions. Okay. There are some special niches for things like sex addiction, for example, or for eating disorders. If you think of those, for example, binge eating disorder is very much like an addiction, mm-hmm, with compulsion and loss of control and adverse consequences. So most of what we do is for drug and alcohol, cannabis, methamphetamine, cocaine. We also provide active nicotine addiction treatment, which is under-recognized and underappreciated, I think, by many people in the field. But we really want to see ourselves moving in towards also process addictions like gambling addiction or sex addiction.
And I'm assuming that we'll soon have screen addiction, social media addictions.
We already do.
Yeah. that as soon as we identify it and want to own it. The problem with those is that so many people are struggling with their own addiction to the, mm-hmm, social media affirmations and, mm-hmm, screens, that we don't recognize it in our children or don't want to recognize it, mm-hmm, in each other because it's become so prominent. And so what inspired the book, The Joy of Recovery?
So I was inspired by really seeing over 30 years what worked for people. Really, the work I do is an incredible blessing. I get to see people transform over a number of years and really transform the curse of addiction into a blessing by virtue of their addiction, they become really beautiful people, mm-hmm, because they're forced to, mm-hmm, by the addiction. And it's just an incredible privilege to be able to watch that. And what I did was about 10, 15 years ago, I just started noting principles of recovery that seemed to be relevant for people who are recovering from addiction. And I came up with about 60 or so principles, and I said, this is what makes recovery work for people. And in looking at those different principles, they all seemed to fall into this magic number of 12 different touchstones of recovery. And so that became the inspiration for the book.
And so the book recently won a couple of awards, correct?
It did.
Would you like to share what they are?
Yes. It won a couple of national book awards, one for the Living Now award for books that make a meaningful contribution to the well-being of society, and then it won a Reader's Choice Award in the nonfiction genre as well.
And so for someone who's devoted his life, I mean, just in the tone of your voice, you can hear that you're driven by love and this desire for people to be able to heal and, yeah. and feel the love and meaningfulness of their life. Yeah. So I can imagine that this book was written with a lot of love. All right, let's go to the phones. Jim, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Jim. I noticed that the doctor addressed pain and for people that were coming out of surgery as far as using opiates, that, and he gave a percentage of people that become long-term addicted. But there's usually very little conversation about people that have chronic pain, like rheumatoid arthritis or some kind of chronic condition where they're forced in a position where over-the-counter drugs don't necessarily work, and they use on a regular basis opiates or sometimes even marijuana or something like that, where they're using those to abate the pain that they've got from this chronic condition. So I guess my question is, would that be considered an addiction also, or are you just being medically treated and it happens to be an opioid that's providing relief from the chronic condition that you have?
Sure.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. Jim, if opioids are causing destruction, adverse consequences, for example, a compulsion to use more and more opioids, or in any way causing compulsions to use where there is a loss of control over the use of them, then that means that there's an addiction, which is very different from dependence. There are some people on long-term opioid treatment who are dependent on their opioids and will go into severe withdrawal if their opioids are stopped. That is not necessarily the same as addiction. What I would also say is that the field of pain management is rapidly evolving right now, and we understand now that the vast majority of people with chronic pain can be effectively treated without opioids.
Jim, is that your experience? I mean, would that answer your question?
Yeah, I know. And I understand that it's answered that there's new pathways to dealing with pain. But from the answer, I'm kind of getting that they're not readily available and that the boilerplate treatment for most pain today, if you go to, unless maybe you go to a specialist at Stanford or something like that, is going to be opioids. And sometimes a more progressive doctor might suggest CBDs or something along that line. But if you have a long-term chronic pain condition, you know, you make a choice. If, you know, Tylenol doesn't work, you know, of using something that does or suffering the daily pain of it and the psychological torment of the pain. So I'm wondering, as far as quality of life goes in the long term, I guess that's an individual choice that people make, you know.
So, Jim, you're feeling like that you have this untenable choice you have to make to live with an addiction to an opioid, but that addiction allows you some quality of life, and without the opioid, the pain would just be unbearable.
Yeah. That's the basic premise of my question. So you may be doing psychological damage to yourself in a way that you're addicted to this drug, but at the same time you're getting relief from the physical pain of it, which is improving your quality of life on another level.
Thank you, Jim. So let's see. I hate to cut you off, but I want to make sure I have Dr. McGee's sure. chance to respond. Thank you.
So the best treatment for pain is multimodal treatment. There's a recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association that showed that long-term treatment, for example, with acetaminophen combined with nonsteroidals or COX-2 inhibitors can give just equal results in pain management as opioids. There are also agents that raise the pain threshold. These are noradrenergic agents. There is CBD oil, which there's some experimental research is showing has benefit. Also, mindfulness acceptance techniques can really de-link suffering from distress and help people to lead joyful lives despite having some degree of somatic distress.
So for someone like Jim, it sounds like he has a desire to have these alternatives. How does the average person who can't afford, you know, to go to the Haven or a specialty clinic get that information, that treatment? Because it doesn't sound like it's mainstream. Thank you for calling, Jim.
Yeah, I think the best thing to do would be go to a pain management specialist, being a well-educated consumer who understands what the different pain management options are, and then going to a progressive pain management specialist who's willing to work to create a team of pain management people. For example, a pain management psychotherapist who works with pain.
And I hear you say that, and then I can sense the frustration in Jim and a lot of people who experience this. You know, there have been pain management clinics. There are pain management clinics that are the pushers. They're the problem. And so if you're someone like Jim who's like, hey, I really want to do this well, and you trust a pain management clinic, you can get in a whole deep pail of water. So I guess... Go ahead.
Very important. There's a misunderstanding about pain management clinics. It turns out 70% or more of people who go to pain management clinics were started on opioids by their primary care doctors.
So by the time they get to the
They were dependent on them.
Okay.
So pain management specialists are being put in the position of managing a problem which they didn't create.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah. I hope that helped, Jim. And so Dr. McGee, people who want to get in touch with you can find you through The Haven?
Yes, they can find me through thehaven.com. They can also find me at thejoyofrecovery.com, and that will lead them to my website.
And do you do any private practice work, or is it all through the clinical work right now?
I have a small private practice in San Luis Obispo, but the bulk of my work is at The Haven.
And so anyone can pick up The Joy of Recovery. It's very readable, and it has such a positive feel to it. You know, what a great way to reframe this idea of addiction, instead of seeing addiction as this demon that comes to us from above, addiction can end up being that gift that opens up our life to possibilities that we never imagined. And I love that you frame it in that perspective, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come in and share your story and offer people a new way of looking at addiction. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have you back. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can find our shows at kcbx.org. Send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Instagram. As always, we appreciate listening, supporting public radio, KCBX, and being a part of our community.
Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.